Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. I take it everybody can hear me. I'm audible to folks with headset. I can hear myself on there. So I hope people aren't going to be disappointed in this talk, as I was talking to people during the break, and I think it's going to be a little different from what people might be thinking. Intoxication. So, anyway, so today was the term closing ceremony, which I really like, and the term opening ceremony equally well. These bookends that we put on the Ango period. In the beginning, we take vows, many of us, and we practice with those through the term. And then we kind of check in with ourselves at the end and see how we did. Sometimes it's pretty satisfying, our work with those vows, sometimes not so much. My vow this term was to pay close attention to intoxication. My old friend. I remember when I first was exposed to the precepts. The fifth of the 10 grave precepts really was a kind of, I bristled at that prohibition. I didn't pay much attention to the polished clarity and dispel delusion part of it, but rather just this do not become intoxicating. This vow related to intoxication came from an interaction I had with this man. At the back of the hall, we were folding chairs and putting them away. Just a few sentences, really, is all we exchanged. And it's interesting what will cause us to pivot, what will really get our attention, what will land. Right. So most of the time when you think about intoxication, you think about drugs and alcohol and drunkenness, right? That's the and those things can really be a problem. Other obvious forms of intoxication are like gambling and edgy TV shows, doom scrolling and social media, et cetera, the coarser forms of intoxication. They can get pretty out of hand. And sometimes, group support and professional intervention and even rehab is necessary for that kind of stuff. But in the context of Buddhist practice, I think limiting or restricting my definition to those kinds of intoxication is really limiting. And it becomes pretty easy to package it up and put it off to the side. I do not get drunk. I do not play video games. I don't even have any social media accounts. Therefore, the precept is addressed. I can check the box. But what I'm much more curious about, and what this talk is about, is intoxicating thought. Much more subtle. And I find intoxicating thinking to be quite seductive and captivating. When I was a kid, I really became attached to daydreaming. I can remember daydreaming deliberately, just really setting aside time and creating pretty vivid daydreams. I was aware they were daydreams, but I did it almost as a form of practice, really, for a long time. And it stays with me now, even as an adult. My daydreams fall into like four primary categories. One of them, of course, is future casting, and often extremely unrealistic, and often doomsday kind of thinking, or maybe overly optimistic. There's the back casting, right? The revisionist history, where I go back in time and I relive events and I act more skillfully and they turn out better. It's true. I've spent a lot of time interfacing with my mother in daydreams, and trying to do a better job of dealing with some of her stuff. And of course, there's just straight up fantasy that has nothing to do with reality. But the fourth type that I really didn't pay much attention to is excessive rehearsing, something I do that I wasn't really aware of. I spend a lot of time, if you're going to talk to a neighbor about a sticky issue, maybe. Day after tomorrow in the morning. Okay, what am I going to say to him and what's he going to say to me? And I found myself sometimes doing this like 25, 30 times, and it becomes quite intoxicating, quite polarizing. And we tend to think of intoxication, at least when I bristled at the precept, I thought of it as this is a pleasurable thing that I'm being asked to sacrifice. But intoxication, I find, is much more often unpleasant than pleasant. We've all been intoxicated by hate at one time or another. And There's certainly a charge that comes with that, a burst of energy, but it's anything but pleasant, right? It's exhausting, painful. It's a terrible experience. With intoxication, there's something that I really noticed during this term, is there's this sense that it's going to do the work for me, right? It's going to carry me forward on this surge of energy, right? That I won't have to try as hard because I've got this stuff that is doing things, it's making the effort on my behalf. It became increasingly obvious that intoxication is delusion in the classic sense, right? This reification of self, really obsessing with self, and then the inevitable follow-on of protecting and pleasing that self that comes out of that, creating desirable fiction. And when you separate like that, it's pretty antithetical to what one of our main things that we're undertaking here is cultivating compassion, that separation, pulling back and hiding. Right? It's always going to occur, but if I pay attention, I can see the suffering that underpins it. So the commentary on the fifth precept says, in the realm of the intrinsically pure Dharma, not harboring delusion is the precept of not becoming intoxicated. Yeah, a harbor is a place of refuge, right? So the precept points to protecting intoxication or protecting delusion, providing a safe place for it to exist. Something that turns out I do quite often, right? More so than I even realize. There's a diffuse notion of reciprocity. As I provide this harbor for delusion, I'm expecting something in return. I'm expecting a reward of some kind, maybe for tolerating aspects of life that I don't like. And the precepts certainly overlap. In the sixth precept, we're urged to avoid praising self and blaming others. And few things are more intoxicating to me than doing just that. And quickly it devolves into what we're also advised not to partake of, and that is haphazard talk. Yeah. My internal commentary when I scroll through the news a little bit, it sometimes goes unnoticed. And when I catch myself, it's pretty shocking, the rage and the judgment and the feeling maybe of superiority that I have, that I'm better than them morally, in terms of wisdom, some way better than they are. So Buddhist practice, how do Zazen and Dharma teaching and interactions in Sangha, how does that help address intoxication? And during this term, I had a really familiar experience. Many times I've had this where I'm learning something that I already know. And vows are helpful in this way because they focus our attention on particular behavior, often a habit, something that maybe we don't normally pay that much attention to. And then when I look past habits, they operate in the background, under the radar, and they cause behaviors, body, speech, and mind. And you can miss that if you're not really paying attention. So I'm thankful to my vow. Unfortunately, when we, well, I should say I, but I think it's true of all of us, when we notice in something like intoxicating thoughts, they tend to crumble and ebb away. And this is always, always, always true. Unless I turn away from practice toward delusion deliberately, that's the one time I think that practice is really being violated. Which is not to say that I don't do that, because I do. I've caught myself numerous times. And what am I doing then? I'm providing that harbor, okay? Turning away and becoming a self and separating. So in the Pali Canon, there's a well-known sutra, the Subjects for Contemplation, Upajjhatana Sutta. And this is the one from which the five remembrances derive: old age, sickness, death, separation from everything and everyone that we love, and karma. We are the heirs to our actions. We're encouraged to reflect. And out of that derives edification and well-being. So in the sutra, the Buddha says this: There are beings who are intoxicated with a living person's intoxication with life. Because of that intoxication with life, they conduct themselves in a bad way in body, in speech, and in mind. But when they often reflect on that fact, that living person's intoxication with life will either be entirely abandoned or grow weaker. So I got a lot out of this. And this is one of several in a row. The first one is intoxication with youth and intoxication with health. This has a specific meaning in the context of the sutra, but it generally applies to intoxication. Often reflecting on that fact, the living person's intoxication will either be entirely abandoned or grow weaker. Now, I know I'm not going to entirely abandon intoxication. In fact, if I'm honest, I was intoxicated a little bit today, sitting on the cushion as I projected about this coming up on the horizon. But I know it's growing weaker. It has grown weaker over the year. I was a college binge drinker and all that stuff. And just little by little, aging and practice have tamed me, and being aware of things has been extremely helpful. Mindfulness and daily activities, sitting zazen, especially in recent years, just observing the urge to indulge. Through practice, I've seen that intoxication delays the inevitable, right? It keeps me, I think it keeps all of us from turning and facing the things in life that we don't want to face, the pain and the loneliness and that fear that those things will become overwhelming and we won't be able to deal with them. It's like, becomes evident that it's a manifestation of a much more basic urge to duck out of what's right here, right now, and get out from under it, or to somehow enhance a life that is perceived to be deficient, like it's not good enough, I need to spice it up. But we're taught that the Dharma wheel turns from the beginning, right? There's neither surplus nor lack. And in moments of quiet openness, which we're fortunate enough to experience at times, that's an undeniable fact. Life is sufficient as it is. Beauty is everywhere. And it's a satisfying event. If I ask myself honestly what's missing from my life, I've done that many times. I'm often stymied. I don't have a very good answer. And sometimes I can trot out some stuff. It'd be better if it was this way or that way. I had this or I did that. Some things, obviously, if we're sick and we heal, that improves the quality of our life and we feel happy from that. If we're missing loved ones and they return, those things are important. But, achievements and experiences and goods and services, these things I have found over the years that they don't really change my experience of life very much at all. If they do, it's only for a very short time. But the moments of meaning, the ones that I'm glad they occur, these moments of beauty, they're simple and without contrivance. And they arise unbidden. They feel much more like gifts than they do procurement. Expensive new, or maybe in my case, not real expensive, but sort of expensive new possession, it brings with it all kinds of worries and concerns. It tends to, the blush is off the rose pretty quickly. But hearing the sound of the wind rustling those cottonwood leaves on a summer afternoon can be a really truly transcendent experience, one of unrestricted joy. But that joy, that feeling, as large as it is not intoxication. Because it arrives with little or no sense of self. If self-attachment is operating, that experience simply will not be the same. It won't be that quiet, opening experience. It's impossible. And if you're really focused on yourself, you won't hear those sounds at all. Momentarily experiencing the gentleness and inclusivity of an untethered mind is an unparalleled event. And it lacks that delusiveness that's the hallmark of intoxication. The sangha is really important, and it sounds like a truism to say that it's harder for me to hide when I'm seen, right? But it really is true. even being partially seen makes it harder for me to hide from myself, which over the years I became pretty skilled at doing. Being seen creates a sense of responsibility, a sense that I'm coming to terms with things, that I'm addressing karma, not just for myself. My behavior is an example to the Sangha, for better or for worse, as is pretty much everybody else's in here, especially those who've been around for a while and are higher profile. I don't like being seen often enough, but I recognize the benefit that's been incurred over the years. I remember when I first encountered Zen. I had been to another Zen center, but the first one where I really did any practice was in Hawaii at Honolulu Diamond Sangha. And I was much more of a stranger to myself then than I am now. I mentioned before learning what I already know. And since I've been practicing, I really haven't been that surprised by some of the stuff that I've seen. It's like it's more an act of admitting than it is learning. The seeing is not seeing something that's unknown to me, but rather taking a deliberate and an honest look at it. Somehow I've been given the capacity through this to hold more and to react less strongly to the stuff that I don't like. Increased willingness to look at life. So sincerely and calmly taking up the moment is exactly what my heart desires. Acquisition and accumulation is not what I've been looking for. It's those experiences of quiet openness, rather than this dissatisfaction from which that urge to become intoxicated arises. And I could have sat zazen for years by myself. In fact, I did this for a while between Honolulu and here. And I was really religious in my practice. I sat every day, twice a day, in the morning and the afternoon, but in a kind of an echo chamber without the support of Sangha, things don't happen as quickly. Much more awakening occurs in the presence of our fellows. So during the past month or so, I've been circling back to a couple of lessons that have really come to the forefront as a result of looking at this intoxication. Something I've noticed for years, which came into much sharper focus in the last few months, is that point at which I turn away from practice. This is the most important thing, probably. It's one thing to sit on your cushion during sesshin and drift away. It happens to all of us. And then we return, where was I? And what brought me back? These are still questions I can't answer. But to stop and deliberately turn away from awareness and participation in the moment and take up delusion is an exceptionally unwholesome activity. People are laughing, so they're familiar with it. But fortunately, I can notice when it's happening, and that's the foothold, right? That's a little bit of leverage, and I can grow and learn from that. I can see the fear and the greed that are at the root of wanting to separate and keep everything at bay. And I noticed a lot, I'm surrounded by resources that support me and encourage me. And not just here, other people, but everywhere I go, there's a sense, if I allow it to penetrate, if I allow it to be observed and happen, I can feel that support. I don't know what it is. Accepting things as they are is pretty difficult sometimes, but warm-hearted and forgiving acceptance of my lack of acceptance is crucial to practice. I've never had any luck at all fighting, a sort of an assertive, forward-leaning practices doesn't work. Seems absurd. But the experience of being soft and quiet, really open, and when everything is welcome, the tent is really big. And everything is in there, the aversions along with that which is grasped after. When everybody seems like they're on equal footing, the aversions are greeted with compassion and kindness. They're seen as benign instead of dangerous. I don't know what really brings that about, but I know that I really appreciate it when it happens. I can't overemphasize enough the kind, gentle, quiet, forgiving quality that allows that which I don't like to exist in plain sight, and I don't try to reject it. So I feel pretty optimistic about my future engagements with intoxication. They're going to continue to occur, but weakening and weakening, just as the sutra says, through simply observation, not trying to troubleshoot or make it happen a certain way, but pay attention and the changes seem to occur. I won't use the word magically, but somehow comes about. So, last thing, I have a sentence here that I wrote down on my kitchen table while I was drinking a cup of coffee before I walked my dog just a couple weeks ago. I read it several times, and it sums up my practice this term with this vow. It says, intoxication takes up space that could otherwise be left wide open. No, but that's how I feel about it too, right? And it's like it takes up space. And why would I want to let that happen? I'd much rather that it could be wide open. So that's all I've got. And that didn't take too long. So what I'm really hoping is that people will share. I know some people might have thought this was about drugs and alcohol, but it isn't. I definitely have. I will say that in my family, there's some serious alcoholism. So I have had a lot of exposure to that. I mean, like terrible. And so, but that's not what this was about. Okay. So that, time for mess.
If you have questions and you're in the room, please raise your hand. When I give you the microphone, please say your name and then state your question. If you're on Zoom and you have a question, you can write your name in the chat and Jay will unmute you, or you can write your question in the chat and Jay will read it for you.
Hey, my name is Haley. I really relate to you like talking about like daydreaming. I have schizophrenia, so that's like daydreaming on hard mode. But my question was, is oftentimes I feel like the daydreams are things that you want to do but can't in the moment, or what want to have but can't in the moment, like even just like say connection with people. Have you figured out how to turn kind of like your daydreams into something that's actionable, or like say reaching out and getting the connection that you want, even if it feels like you can't really get that at the moment? I don't know. Does that make sense?
Makes sense. Yeah. It's like the difference between a daydream and an aspiration. I guess what I would look for in myself would be, how much am I separating? How much am I cherishing myself in my daydream? And because like I think if my aspiration is to connect with others, the daydream is going to be very short, right? It's not going to go on and on and on. I'm not going to explore the subtle nuances of that. More likely, if I do that, there's some self-aggrandizing that's taking place. I'm not saying this is for you, true, but in my case, that's how it is. I don't usually find it very helpful to like, I mean, I think visualization may work for people in certain ways, but I'm not so sure that that's, I don't think that's daydreaming. I don't know. It might be very weird and don't have anything to do with something as noble as good aspiration.
We have a question on Zoom. Let's see.
Hey, Blake, guy. This is Renzo. I'm so glad that I came to hear your talk today. This was a really lovely talk, and I did not think it was going to be about drugs and alcohol. And it feels very timely for me as I settle into this new part of my life. And sort of also as part of that casting around for like what practice and sangha look like for me here. Definitely have found myself a little prone to like turning away from practice and being intoxicated by, well, you were just talking about aspirations, and I think about the way my aspirations and my whims or moods conflict sometimes. And I have caught myself definitely stepping into those whims and moods and being intoxicated by those and, you know, turning away from practice in that intentional way. So it was really, it was just really lovely to hear your thoughts about it today and very helpful.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, this is Genko. I mean, those are interesting questions about the differences between dreams and delusions and aspirations and hopes. But what I was really struck by in your talk was what I would call something about allowing and awareness and weakening and how this is actually can be and often is most effectively a fairly gentle process. I know that when I first started trying to work on my stuff, I was like, I was gonna take care of this. And I was, you know, very trying to hit it over the head and it just got worse. And it wasn't until I could really back off and be more gentle with it and allow things to happen. I think there is a magical quality to it, or at least something that can't really quite be explained or described. But I think that process is, you know, I think you've hit on some really key factors of it, which is just a simple awareness, noticing, but also Sangha is a big part of it in, again, some kind of mysterious way sometimes.
Right.
And I think that's one of the things that I try to not emphasize, because as soon as you're doing that, now you're getting into like controlling and hitting people over the heads, but at least to allow for, to try to create an environment where that can happen with people. And because then that seems to be more effective than just trying to explain.
Right, yeah. Trying to fix.
Yeah, try to fix it.
Right. Troubleshoot.
Yeah, troubleshooting it. Yeah. Yeah, all that stuff that we're so taught how to do.
Right, it works in some situations.
Yeah,
it's not
let's
so well.
Figure this out and we'll get it done. Right. Yeah, maybe.
Maybe. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Hi.
Howdy.
I'm Reju. So, I really... also this term, noticed my kind of intoxication in the way that you put it, about like rehearsing and scripting and like going over and over and over again, exhausting. And I also noticed that, you know, that's like an anxiety response, but part of the anxiety, at least in my case, is that big open space that you reference at the end with your like table quote. And just like the overwhelm of sensation of letting reality in.
Right.
And rehearsing is a way to like protect from that.
The harbor.
Yeah.
Right. No, thank you. I'm glad that worked. Yeah.
What do you do?
What do I do? I have had that experience of being a little like overwhelmed and frightened by like more naked life. But that went away, you know. It's like I'm pretty happy to have that experience that comes and takes, you know, it comes and takes me instead of me going to get it. And there's when that softness and that forgiveness and that gentleness and that kindness and that acceptance, those kinds of words, those are game changers, right? Because that's what life is really like. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Lindsay. Thank you for your talk. I really appreciated it. And I wanted, this is a comment, but I think there is a question, even though I just want to say, I think you addressed this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, but I experienced a lot of intoxication during your talk, and I do during a lot of Dharma talks. So very, I know. I was really intoxicated. I was so mad at myself because I'm like, it was my job to make sure your cushion was there. And I totally, you or somebody else set that up. I totally forgot that was something I was supposed to do. And I felt so bad. You know, I was like, oh, I'm going to talk to that guy. I apologize. Like, I was supposed to do that. And I think one of my hooks is like, I'm supposed to do a good job. And like, you know, yeah, and I think we all in our roles, especially when we're doing these types of roles, it's really hard to not get caught in that. And, you know, and it's just so ironic because you're like sharing this talk about intoxication. And I'm aware, I'm like, I'm intoxicated by like feeling bad about this thing, you know, that, you know, whatever, really. But and it's so hard to be in that wide open space. And what's, I think, really tricky for me, and maybe I would hope you could speak to maybe a little bit more, is like that awareness does come. I'm aware. I know exactly what I'm doing. I know I can like let myself off the hook with this one. And like, I can, I've missed so many Dharma talks while I was sitting here because of something like that or some similar daydream. And then I get bummed out. I was like, and maybe that's just the experience I'm supposed to be having in that moment. But I was wondering if you could speak to that at all.
Well, I think you're the only one that's ever
Clearly.
You know, I've learned to be a lot less worried about whether I get it right.
Yeah.
You know, it's much more like if something is being ad-libbed, it's not that it's being, okay, so a mistake was made, but how is that mistake handled? You know, is it graceful? Is it easy? Are you forgiving? You know, I'm the one who put the water here, but I never once had any feelings of like, why wasn't there? Is that Jisha? You know, so no, yeah.
Well, sure, that's my own like delusion, right? That it's, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably a good idea to put the water there, but at the same time, it's, yeah, certainly nothing worth generating suffering over.
Yeah, I guess I, no, I think that's it. Thank you, yes.
Hey, Dyke, I loved your talk. Thank you, it's Kristen. I was going to ask a question, but you just kind of answered it with the, you made a distinction between things that, the distinction between you reaching out and grabbing something and being, what did you say? Being.
Comes in to get me.
Comes in to get me.
Maybe that's being actualized by the myriad thing.
Yeah. That's really helpful. Because, you know, I struggle with the whole realm of like pretty clear, unwholesome delusion, intoxication kind of things. But the less clear things is what I was going to ask about, like beauty, like taking in beauty or something and being kind of intoxicated by it. But it's, I was always curious about the, or concerned, I guess, you know, like what you were saying when the rustling of the leaves with the cottonwood in the summer, you know, in the back of my head, sometimes I'm like, is this bad, you know, to just revel in this? But there's a clear distinction there that you made that, you know, and that's really helpful. Thank you.
I mean, if I'm reveling in those, in that, and if it's bad, I'm probably just going to keep being bad. You know, I think that the real distinguishing factor is like, what, observe what the self is doing,
right?
If it's not really even there at all, I think it's probably, you know, here comes the hard question.
You said during the break that you wanted a hard hitting response.
I was just teasing.
This is Jiko. Dispel delusion, fine. What about polished clarity? What about the effort and the act of polishing clarity?
Yeah, effort is a funny thing. You know, there's right effort and there's wrong effort. I can tell the difference when I experience it. I'd have a heck of a time trying to explain in words what differentiates between those two. You know, I can feel tight, I can feel grasp, I can feel lockdown, I can feel stealth, or I can feel the opposite of those. And effort can be made in both of those ways. And I trust the one, and I'm really on the lookout for the other.
think it's pretty easy for us to fall into the let it happen, accept, don't troubleshoot it, you know, let things come to you, and miss the part of, wait a minute, I need to lean into this. I need to work a little bit.
Right. Right. Yeah. Fair enough. You know, it's like, been through a lot of sesshin.
Yeah.
You know, they've been pretty arduous at times. Here we go again. You know? So, I mean, I think sometimes there's just going to be wrong effort, and that's just what you're going to get for that day.
This is Jen. I'm really glad you brought up rehearsing. That is like, I think a few years ago, I realized that's like 90% of my thinking. I don't even like have a voice to myself. Lots of times it's just me talking to other people. And that was my thinking. And that was such a revelation when I realized that. But like, it has been a big hang up for me to try to stop doing that, because then it's become this invitation for a lot of inner conflict, exhausting inner conflict of like, okay, here's the habit pattern of my mind is to rehearse, and I'm not supposed to be rehearsing. And there's this like, I don't want to be rehearsing. That creates this tension and this conflict. And like, it's actually been really healthy for me to be just like, oh, okay, you know, I'm rehearsing, kind of that gentleness Genko was talking about, just like, oh, okay, it's happening. Or like Lindsay talked about, like, oh God, I messed up and I'm doing it again and again. Okay, that's happening. And sometimes that's just going to happen and happen and happen and happen and happen. And like the idea that I'm not supposed to be doing it can be very counterproductive to my practice. And also this term, I actually leaned more into playing video games and more into reading fantasy as a way of resting my mind. Because when my mind is more rested, I'm less likely to get caught up in these tense kinds of conflict. So I'm curious what you think about that.
Yeah, I'm not maligning video games or books, you know. I'm not even maligning alcohol. You know, some people have a pint of beer, it's just fine. I guess when I hear all that there's like, some of your gestures were even like grabbing the fist and I'm not supposed to do this. That's the point of study, right? And so I remember at Kyogen's memorial at that Unitarian church, there was like a Shosan exercise with the teacher. And one of the teachers said that she felt kind of almost ashamed of herself because she was suffering so much. That she was a Zen teacher. This was after Gyokuto. And she goes, when is it too much suffering? How much should I sit with it? And Gyokuto's response was, sit with the suffering as long as you can stand it, and then watch a silly movie, right? So, you know, that was from her in front of like 700 people or whatever, or in that, yeah. And I've never forgotten that, obviously. And I've done, I don't really watch silly movies, but I've done other things. Yeah. I think just being aware of what you're doing and why you're doing it is probably sufficient.
We have a comment on Zoom from Grant. Go up to read it. Before today, I saw no intoxication as an arbitrary rule for clarity, but now I see it more as another form of attachment or clinging. We become attached to our intoxications for stress relief, connection to others, escape from responsibility, etc., and we shouldn't harbor any attachment. Thank you for your insights.
Yeah, be careful with that. Attachment is one of those things, and it's bound to happen. It's another subject for study. And just as long as we don't get into that mode of really hating our propensity toward attachment, I think just keep things open.
Thank you for your Dharma talk. My name is Adrian. This may be a bit of a reformulation of some of the questions that have been asked, but you know, our practice can provide a lot of wonderful things. Sangha is wonderful, relieving some of that emotional stress is wonderful, but there's also effort, and maybe not the compulsion is the right word, but you know, the encouragement to keep our Zen in every moment. How do we prevent ourselves from becoming intoxicated by our practice itself?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think a lot of people do, you know, when they first start out, it can become just one more version of ambition and unrealistic ideas about what life can be like. I know it was that way for me. You know, it took years to come to terms with what this is really about. It's about being here, being in this place, and acting skillfully, being available to other beings. I think a shift takes place at some point, you know, where the emphasis comes off of myself, or came off of myself, and started to become wider. And that, I think, was the turning point, you know. So you use the word compulsion, you know, if there's a sense that that's going on, you know, you can, I can see how a person would, in, you know, that could, that the compulsion could wake up and come to life in the context of Zen, because there's so much the sense that everything is to be done a certain way and to be done right and all this kind of stuff, right? And it can be something kind of sticky. I've heard the expression, the stink of Zen. Yeah. I think, what is your aim? Is the Bodhisattva vows? And if so, then I think over time things will clarify more and more.
Thank you.
There's one or two more.
Ogetsu here. A little loud, sorry. How do you distinguish between wholesome and unwholesome forms of intoxication? And let me elaborate just a little bit. This morning I woke up with a piece of music in my head. And the first thing I did, or almost the first thing I did, was go downstairs and put it on and listen to it. It was a solo jazz piano, beautifully played, and it was intoxicating. It was mentally sensually pleasurable, and it definitely took up space when I could have been doing something else, such as meditating, which is what I would have otherwise been doing first thing on Sunday morning. Also, I would say exercise can be intoxicating. So if it's wholesome or healthy, you just not consider it intoxication?
Yeah, I mean, the root word of intoxication is toxic, right? And so I knew somebody who was a runner, long distance runner. I was myself, and we would go on work trips. And if she couldn't run, she was agitated. I mean, and it was more mental than it was physical. She had a compulsion to do it. You know, that didn't seem wholesome to me at all. You know, I could let it go when I had to, but exercising and getting, you know, that which takes place in the body, whatever all the endorphins and whatever else, I don't think that has anything to do with intoxication. I just think that's the benefit of exercise. And as far as the jazz piece, you know, deviating from your normal routine and doing that instead might have been a great thing. I listened to music, and I remember once reading Thich Nhat Hanh talking about listening to music. He was saying, listen very carefully to the music. Try to feel what the composer was feeling, trying to convey, right? But don't get lost in the music, is what he suggested. And so there's a deep attentiveness without being lost. So maybe that's the difference. I don't know.
That works for me. Usually the longest I go without listening to music is when I'm in Sesshin.
Yeah.
And singing the refuges at the end of the day is sometimes the most beautiful music I've ever heard.
Yeah. Yeah, it sure can be.
Yeah. Thank you for your talk.
Yeah. One more? Been trying for a long time.
Hi, this is Julia. It's funny you mentioned time, because that's what I've been thinking about. in relation to intoxication, I feel like time is a huge factor for me. And something that I experience, especially post-Sesheen, is that time feels different. And like sometimes time isn't even the right name for it, but I experience every moment as existing independently from me. And even the book that I'm holding has its own volition. And sometimes it says, I'm done. That's all.
Yeah, I'm not gonna say anything to that. Thank you. That's it. Thank you, everybody.